A1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Alice Bryant, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Dr. Bassem Usman says his life changed on August 4th. At around 6 p.m., he was getting ready to leave the hospital in Beirut where he works. Then, a huge explosion shook the city. Hundreds of wounded people came to the American University of Beirut Medical Center, one of Lebanon's best hospitals. Doctors who had worked through Lebanon's civil war said they had never seen anything like it. In 6 hours, they used as many emergency supplies as they would normally use in 1.5 years. Usman, a 27-year-old resident, worked for the next 52 hours. He treated more than 20 people. One of them died. Explosive chemicals, left for years at Beirut's port, caused the disaster. The explosion has increased public anger against Lebanon's officials, who are also blamed for the country's economic crisis. More than 190 people were killed. Thousands of people were injured. Tens of thousands of homes were damaged or destroyed. Day by day, these crises are becoming our normal life, Usman told the AP. We are tired. It feels like one long marathon. Usman's earnings dropped in value from nearly $1,300 a month to just around $200 a month because of the local currency's crash. He worries harder days may be ahead. Usman, at the beginning of his career, finds himself in a medical field that is having problems. Lebanon's medical centers were once considered among the best in the Middle East. In a short time, they have been brought to near collapse. They have been hurt by Lebanon's financial problems and an increase in coronavirus cases. New medical supplies are not coming fast enough. Medical centers hit by the economic crisis are firing employees. More doctors are leaving the country. It will cost nearly $30 million to repair medical centers damaged by the explosion, the World Health Organization estimates. At the same time, the health system faces a sharp increase in coronavirus cases. The International Rescue Committee, an aid group, says that since August 4th, there has been a 220% increase in reported infections. One woman recently contacted Usman on social media. She asked for suggestions about finding a plastic surgeon, a special kind of doctor who repairs or improves people's appearances. The reason for her question? Her wounds from the explosion were stitched badly. Stitches are special pieces of thread that are used to hold wounds closed. The woman did not realize that Usman was the one who did the stitching. Usman admitted responsibility, noting that the work was done under mobile phone lights. He asked her to return. She did for coffee. He apologized to her in person. Later, In an Instagram post, she thanked him for putting her back together and saving her life. I'm John Russell.
The future may mean more dengue and less malaria in parts of Africa if the planet continues to warm, a new study says. Humans contract the diseases through mosquito bites. The Anopheles mosquito carries a parasite that causes malaria. Dengue is caused by a virus carried by the Aedes mosquito. These two mosquitoes also do best in different climates. Malaria mosquitoes thrive in temperatures of about 25 degrees Celsius. Dengue mosquitoes like it hotter, by about 4 degrees. Erin Mordecai is assistant professor of biology at Stanford University in California. She is the lead writer of the study. Mordecai said climate change may weaken the spread of malaria but increase the spread of dengue. Combining mosquito temperature data, population numbers, and climate expectations, the researchers predicted malaria and dengue risks for Africa. The dengue mosquito is expected to spread across sub-Saharan Africa fully by 2080. And a resulting rise in dengue cases is not the only worry. Aedes mosquitoes can also carry chikungunya, Zika, and yellow fever viruses. At the same time, the researchers say, malaria risk will drop as Anopheles mosquitoes move further south and into mountainous areas seeking cooler temperatures. The researchers say that the growth of cities in Africa may further increase the risk of dengue. The Aedes mosquito reproduces in very small, often human-made containers like bottle covers. Such environments are more commonly found in cities, said Mordecai. The Anopheles mosquito lays its eggs in larger, natural bodies of water, like lakes and rivers. Cities are usually also warmer than surrounding rural areas, a better environment for the heat-loving Aedes. We're predicting that dengue is going to become a much bigger problem in Africa, said Desiree Labode, who helped write the study. She is an expert on infectious diseases in children at Stanford University. Africa is probably not well prepared to fight dengue, she said. It has fought the spread of malaria with some success, but dengue will require new preventative measures. And, Mordecai says, tools for identifying dengue disease are not widely available on many parts of the continent. I'm Alice Bryant.
Scientists say they have discovered evidence that some planets in the universe could be made of diamonds. The research centered on exoplanets, planets that orbit a star outside Earth's solar system. Arizona State University led the team of researchers. They say some carbon-rich exoplanets likely have the right conditions to hold high levels of diamond. Some of the planets could also be made of silica, a mineral found on Earth in forms such as sand and quartz. These exoplanets are unlike anything in our solar system, said Harrison Allen Sutter, with Arizona State University's School of Earth and Space Exploration. He is the lead writer of a study on the findings recently published in the Planetary Science Journal. The researchers said that stars and planets sharing a solar system form from the same cloud of gas. This means they contain the same minerals. Earth, for example, orbits the Sun, which has a low carbon-to-oxygen ratio. So Earth, too, has a low carbon level, resulting in very small amounts of diamond. The Earth is estimated to contain only about 0.001% diamond. But exoplanets that orbit stars with a higher carbon-to-oxygen ratio than the Sun are more likely to be carbon-rich. The researchers suggest that these planets could convert carbon into diamond and silicate if water is also present. This could result in many planets being made mainly of diamonds. In 2012, scientists announced they had discovered an exoplanet twice the size of Earth, believed to be made largely of diamond. Astronomers said the rocky planet called 55 Cancri E was likely covered in graphite and diamond rather than water and granite. In the new study, the scientists carried out laboratory tests to support their research. They attempted to recreate conditions inside carbon-rich exoplanets with an experiment involving heat and pressure. The team pressed samples of silicon carbide, a chemical mixture of silicon and carbon, between diamonds in water. Then, to measure the reaction between silicon carbide and water, the researchers used lasers to create high heat. They used X-ray technology to measure reactions as the sample was heated at high pressure levels. The researchers reported that the high heat and pressure caused the silicon carbide to react with water, turning it into diamonds and silica. While the study provided new evidence that some exoplanets might contain the highly valued substance, it did not suggest that such planets could also hold life. This is because these carbon-rich exoplanets likely do not have the conditions to support life forms. The researchers said the inside of such planets would be so hard that they could not be geologically active. A lack of geologic activity would probably make it impossible for the planets to create an atmosphere. Atmospheres are very important for living things because they can provide air and permit liquid water. Harrison Allen Sutter said new telescope equipment from the U.S. space agency NASA has helped scientists better observe and learn more about exoplanets than ever before. Astronomers have already confirmed the existence of more than 4,000 exoplanets. The more we learn, the better we'll be able to interpret new data from upcoming future missions to understand the worlds beyond our own solar system, he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. We have been talking about the War of 1812 between the United States and Britain. In the summer of 1814, the two countries opened peace talks at Ghent in Belgium. But Britain was in no hurry to agree on a peace treaty. This week, we tell the story of how the war ended. British forces were planning several campaigns in the United States in the autumn and winter of 1814. Successful military campaigns could force the United States to accept the kind of treaty Britain wanted. British representatives to the talks demanded that the United States give control of its Northwest Territory to the Indians. They also asked that the United States give part of the state of Maine to Canada and make other changes in the border. The Americans made equally tough demands. The United States wanted payment for damages suffered during the war. It also wanted the British to stop seizing American sailors for the British Navy. And the United States wanted all of Canada. The British representatives said they could not even discuss the question of stopping impressment by Americans into the British Navy. And the Americans would surrender none of their territory. Most of America's representatives had little hope the talks would succeed. But then Britain received word that its military campaigns had failed at Baltimore and Plattsburgh. After that, the British representatives became easier to negotiate with. They dropped their demands for American territory. The Americans then dropped their demands for Canadian territory. The issues that had led to the war no longer existed. Britain's war with France had caused the British and French to interfere with neutral American trade. And Britain had needed men for its navy. Now the war with France was over. No longer was there any reason to interfere with the trade of any nation. And no longer was there any need to seize Americans for service in the British Navy. On December 24th, the day before Christmas in 1814, the United States and Britain signed a simple treaty. Each side agreed to stop fighting. They also agreed to settle all their differences at future negotiations. The war had ended, but one more battle was to be fought before news of the peace treaty reached the United States. During the autumn of 1814, British soldiers at Jamaica began preparing for an attack against New Orleans, a city at the mouth of the Mississippi River. Late in November, this force of about 7,500 men sailed from Jamaica to New Orleans. The British soldiers were commanded by General Edward Pakenham. The general did not take his men directly to the mouth of the Mississippi River. Instead, they sailed across a lake east of the city. Early during the afternoon of December 23rd, General Andrew Jackson, the commander of American forces at New Orleans, learned that the British force was near. General Jackson was a good soldier and a great leader. He fought in the Revolutionary War, then studied law. He moved west to Nashville, Tennessee. The general also served in both houses of the United States Congress. When war broke out in 1812, he was elected general of a group of volunteer soldiers from Tennessee. Jackson was a rough man. His soldiers feared and respected him. They called him Old Hickory because he seemed as tough as hickory wood. Jackson was given responsibility for defending the coast along the Gulf of Mexico. Earlier in the year, he had attacked Pensacola in Florida and forced out several hundred British Marines. Jackson believed the British would attack Mobile before attacking New Orleans. He left part of his forces at Mobile and took the others to the mouth of the Mississippi. Jackson was a sick man when he got to New Orleans, and what he found made him feel no better. Little had been done to prepare for the expected British attack. Jackson declared martial law and began building the city's defenses. Most of the work on the defenses had been completed when Jackson got word that the British were only a few kilometers from New Orleans. "Gentlemen," Jackson told his officers, "the British are below. We must fight them tonight." The British soldiers rested. They believed it would be easy to capture the city the next day. But Jackson rushed up guns and men and attacked the British by surprise just after dark. Then the Americans retreated to a place about 8 kilometers south of the city. Jackson had chosen this place carefully. On the right was the Mississippi River. On the left was the mud and water of a swamp that could not easily be crossed. In front of the American soldiers was an open field. For 2 weeks, the British soldiers waited. They tested the American defenses at several places, but found no weaknesses. Every day, Jackson had his men improve their positions. At night, small groups of Jackson's soldiers would slip across the field and silently attack British soldiers guarding the other side. Finally, on January 8th, the British attacked. They expected the Americans to flee in the face of their strong attack, but the Americans stood firm. Jackson's artillery fired into the enemy. When the British got as close as 150 meters, the Americans began to fire their rifles. The rain of bullets and shells was deadly. General Pakenham was wounded twice and then killed by a shell that exploded near him. Only one British soldier reached the top of the American defenses. The British finally retreated. They left behind more than 2,000 dead and wounded. 500 other British soldiers had been captured. 13 Americans were killed. It was a great victory for the United States, but one that was not necessary. The war had ended by treaty 2 weeks earlier. Historian Alan Taylor says the peace treaty saved the United States from a very grim situation.
the United States government was bankrupt. It had lost its credit, and it could not raise enough in taxes for the war effort, and most creditors were refusing to lend any more money to the United States. And so it was very unclear how the Americans would conduct another campaign in 1815, because it looked like they wouldn't have the money for it.
The Senate acted quickly to approve the treaty. On February 17th, 1815, President Madison declared the war officially ended. It had lasted 2 years and 8 months and united the American people. On the 4th of July in 1815, the nation celebrated its 39th anniversary of independence. In Washington, the man who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, Francis Scott Key, spoke at the celebrations. Historian Alan Taylor says many people call the War of 1812 America's second war for independence, but he calls it America's first civil war. He says the country had been divided throughout the war, but things changed after Andrew Jackson's victory at New Orleans.
And so Americans then concluded that the war had really been a glorious occasion that had defended national honor and proved the merit of their republican institutions. And they were so relieved by all of this that they decided to celebrate the war in their memories.
Albert Gallatin, Madison's Treasury Secretary and one of the negotiators at Ghent, said people felt more American after the war. They feel and act more like a nation. Alan Taylor says the War of 1812 was very difficult for the United States, yet Americans remember it as a feel-good war. At the same time, he says, the War of 1812 also united Canadians.
Despite all of their divisions during the war, they felt so relieved that they had fended off American invasion that they remembered the war as a glorious victory over the more powerful United States.
As a result of the war, Alan Taylor says both Americans and Canadians felt a greater sense of nationalism. And because of that, the two nations could relate more peacefully. Each believed it could survive without having to defeat the other.
And today, Canada and the United States are each other's primary trade and security partner in the world.
But not everyone benefited from the end of the war. The opposition Federalist Party found itself greatly embarrassed by the peace. Its leaders had long denounced the war and said Britain could not be defeated. Many of the Federalists had traded with the enemy. Some had worked with the British against their own country. They had even threatened to break up the Union. Once the war was over, the Federalist Party lost its supporters. And then the party itself soon disappeared, even in the New England states, its base of support. The end of the Federalist Party changed politics in the United States. The changes started as early as the next presidential election in 1816. James Madison continued the tradition begun by George Washington and Thomas Jefferson of serving only 8 years as president.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.